You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll look at how the 1988 Lockerbie attack changed the face of aviation for good.
It's interesting looking at these photos 25 years later and seeing all the debris sitting on the ground, thinking that the plane literally just exploded in flight because a bomb was placed in the cargo hold.
And talk to John Ashton, the writer who says the bomber was the victim of a political fix.
Also on the program, we'll be setting the day's agenda with journalist and author Ben Judah. Ben, what do you have for us this morning?
We'll be looking at Ukraine to see whether or not Putin has saved or enslaved the country after bailing it out from the threat of bankruptcy. The US will be sending gay athletes as part of its Sochi delegation, and will Pussy Riot be freed as part of Putin's amnesty?
And we'll be returning to Ben a little bit later in the programme. In a preview of next week's Globalist Lookback specials, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, reflects on the design stories of 2013.
I think there's still a lot of soul-searching, the fact that this company, for all intents and purposes, you know, it's fully Swiss owned. And a big question mark as to, does it even have a future in Finland?
So all that, plus we'll play some music as well and leaf through the Italian front pages too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Amnesty International says that war crimes are being committed in the Central African Republic as calls grow for the UN to intervene. It says 2 weeks ago rebels killed almost 1,000 people in a two-day rampage, double an earlier UN estimate. Human Rights Watch says a United Nations peacekeeping mission is needed in CAR as fighting continues and more people become displaced. European Union leaders are set to rubber stamp a deal agreed overnight for tighter controls on banks across the region. A summit is taking place in Brussels, where approval will be given to a new body that will take action against failing lenders. The move is aimed to prevent the type of financial crisis caused by troubled banks in Ireland, Cyprus and Spain. Monocle's Brussels correspondent, Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, says it's a landmark deal.
This banking union is seen as crucial to restoring confidence in the single currency after the disasters of the last couple of years. And the idea is to create a central authority overseeing the 17 Eurozone countries, overseeing banks in those countries, and working out a framework, a blueprint and a fund for how to wind down those banks so that failing banks don't drag down government economies with them.
A White House-appointed panel has proposed a number of curbs on National Security Agency surveillance in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks. It recommends limits on a program to collect records of billions of telephone calls, saying the data should be kept by an independent third party. The report, which includes 40 recommendations, says that in future, any monitoring of world leaders would have to be approved at the highest level. Brazil has awarded a $4.5 billion contract to Swedish company Saab to replace its aging fleet of fighter jets. It's the company's largest ever foreign order and will see 36 new aircraft supplied by 2020. Brazil had been expected to place the order with Boeing, but it's believed the revelation that the National Security Agency had spied on the president Dilma Rousseff led Brazil to think it couldn't trust a US company. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has told India he regrets the treatment of a diplomat from the country who was arrested and strip-searched. Devyani Khobragade was detained over allegations of visa fraud and of illegally underpaying a maid. It's prompted an angry response from India, where the Prime Minister called her treatment deplorable. Marie Harf speaks for the Secretary of State.
It's also particularly important, Secretary Kerry, that foreign diplomats serving in the United States are accorded respect and dignity, just as we expect our own diplomats should receive overseas as well. As a father of two daughters about the same age, the Secretary empathizes with the sensitivities we are hearing from India about the events that unfolded after the arrest.
$1 million drawing by Pablo Picasso has been snapped up by a 25-year-old American art lover at an online charity raffle for a mere $140. Jeffrey Ganano said he'd been looking for a picture to hang on his living room wall when he found out about Sotheby's online auction of the picture, Man with Opera Hat. The sale was given the green light by Picasso's grandson, who said his grandfather would have been thrilled that his work was being put to good use. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David Spencer. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour to update those stories for us.
I wonder if he'll keep it, do you think?
The picture?
The picture.
The person from the auction said it's possible he could sell it. Very quick profit, that.
That's pretty good.
Quicker than Royal Mail shares.
Quicker than Royal Mail Post at the moment as well.
I picture him living in like a university dorm room type flat.
Wouldn't it be great?
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Have the PlayStation there and a Picasso above you.
And next to the Che Guevara poster.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks very much, David. It's 5 minutes past the hour. David, we'll be back in just under 25 minutes now with another check of your world headlines. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with a look at some of the top stories over the next 24 hours. And joining us today in the studio is Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome to the program, Ben. I think there's only really one place for us to start, a couple places, but let's begin in the Ukraine, shall we?
Yes. Well, dramatic events have been going on in the Ukraine over the past few weeks as protests against the government of Viktor Yanukovych engulfed the streets of Kiev following his decision not to sign an accord with the EU. What this was really about isn't about a technical trade agreement with the EU, but it's about Ukrainian independence. And the protesters believe that over the past few years, Ukraine has slid into a Russian sphere of influence. So Ukraine has been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy over the past few weeks. Ukraine is the third most likely country to default in the world, and its yields were shooting up perilously high. And there was hope in Brussels and in Washington that Yanukovych would be forced to come begging to the West for a bailout, which would have seen the country move decisively away from Russia. But Putin has stepped in, and Ukraine has been given $15 billion from Moscow and has had a third of the price of gas knocked off. So that sum is so huge, it's the equivalent to 17% of Russia's national wealth fund, that's its national savings from the oil and gas boom. So a quick look at the papers in Moscow shows that the main daily Kommersant has a Kremlin source going, "They belong to us now." Whereas the Russian finance minister gave a statement going, "I believe Russia won."
Well, of course, the Ukrainians themselves, a lot of them are feeling very, very shaky about this because it's very unclear exactly what Russia's getting in return.
Well, firstly, there's no one Ukraine. Ukraine, perhaps more so than other countries, has very, very distinct regions. You have a Russian-speaking east and a Russian-speaking south. You have a Ukrainian-speaking west and a Russian-speaking but Ukrainian-feeling centre. And these regions look in different directions. The south and the east look towards Russia traditionally. The west looks towards Europe and especially Poland. And the wave of protests over the past few weeks has been centred pretty much in Kiev and in Lviv and in the west. In fact, in eastern Ukraine and in southern Ukraine, there's a lot of sympathy towards Russia and people feel themselves close to Russia and are keen for economic ties to continue there. In fact, because of the way the old Soviet economy was built, people in Donetsk, Kharkov, in these eastern mining towns are very frightened that Ukraine would disengage itself from the Russian economy because their trade depends on selling coal and factory utensils to Russia.
Well, Ben, the thing that I guess surprises me is, of course, when the initial deal with the EU was announced that it would no longer be taking place, we saw those huge protests across Kiev. But since this deal was announced a few days ago, we haven't seen the same level of protest or the same intensity of protest, I don't think, on the streets of Kiev. Is there a feeling that it's just a little too late, and now Ukraine is really tied to Russia?
Well, there are two ways you can deal with a protest if it breaks out in your capital city. The first way is to try and get rid of it immediately by smacking people's heads and chasing them away. The second way to deal with it, and this, in my opinion, is far more effective in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, is just ignore them. And just to let them sit out there in their tents and kind of roll cigarettes and drink and sing and strum guitars until they get cold and they go home. And what Putin has decided to do with this deal is to offer the Ukrainian leadership that's loyal to him enough money to simply survive without asking, without asking for the crucial payback, which is to join his customs union. So if Putin had asked in the text of the agreement that Ukraine should join the customs union, then you could have had an explosion of protest. But because there's nothing you should specifically protest about, the idea is the protest will fizzle out, and then in a few months, maybe after the Sochi Olympics, Putin can revisit it and ask for payback.
Can Russia afford it? Because Russia's economy itself is very fragile. They've had to dip into a rainy day fund, really, haven't they?
In short, yes. For now, Russia can afford it. The question is, in the long term, can Russia afford it? And this comes back to the main source of fragility and insecurity in Russia, which is that the entire Russian economy, in fact, the entire Russian state, is based on the one thing in Russia that Putin doesn't control, which is the price of oil.
Ben, let's move on to Sochi Olympics, just less than 2 months away now from the start of those winter games, the most expensive Olympics ever in history, a bit of a statement for Putin. A couple interlinking stories here, though, when it comes to Sochi.
Just as a quick comment, the Sochi Olympics cost almost three times more than Ukraine.
Unbelievable.
And, well, when in the summer I wrote a column for Reuters saying that because of the scale of human rights abuses in Russia, the return of political prisoners, persecution against kind of gay rights, that world leaders should think about an unofficial boycott of the opening ceremony, and that Obama, Hollande and the German president and should stay away. I thought I'd gone a bit far. I thought I'd written a sort of crazy column. So to my surprise, over the past month, in fact, the German president announced that he would not be going to Sochi. The French president will not be going to Sochi. Obama will not be going to Sochi. And now Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, will not be going to Sochi. And what I'm particularly pleased with is that Obama will be sending two kind of leading US gay athletes to Sochi as a wonderful snub to Putin's homophobic state policies. So that's kind of Billie Jean King and Kathleen Cao. The US delegation, in fact, has another snub to it, which is that the most senior political figure in those heading to Sochi will be Janet Napolitano, who is a former Homeland Security Secretary, and her public role now is the head of California's public university system. That's a real Cold War level. We are completely uninterested in your opening ceremony that will involve boats, possibly even Putin on the ice, and giant statues walking on the ice of Peter the Great and Alexander Nevsky and other Russian heroes.
Now, is it likely that Pussy Riot girls will be released in time for this?
Well, this brings us to the third big story of the day. There's something quite medieval about this, which is to celebrate the 20th year of the Russian Constitution, there will be an amnesty for prisoners. I don't know of another country that has amnesties for prisoners to celebrate its constitution apart from Russia, but 20,000 people are about to be let out of jail free, and they include minors, invalids, veterans, pregnant women, and mothers. Crucially, the two Pussy Rioters still in jail are both mothers. So will they be released? It appears that they will. And this planned amnesty appears to have been Putin's plan to make a big statement about how human rights aren't as bad as we think they are in Russia before the Olympics, to prevent what's just happened with the unofficial leaders' boycott on the opening ceremony. We'll also see political prisoners from the Bolotnaya trials. Those are guys that were sent into over a year of pretrial detention for scuffling with police. But the two people are missing. We won't see Khodorkovsky on the list of people being released, and Alexei Navalny's crime, which he's not in jail, will not will not be suspended.
And it has been decades since we've seen the Olympic movement and the Olympic Games used in this type of political manner. Are the Sochi Olympics going to be the biggest flop in Olympic history?
I think that's I'm not quite sure if they'll be the biggest flop in Olympic history. I have a feeling, just from like observing the Russian state, that when Russia throws vast amounts of effort at things, at the last moment it kind of pulls it together, and the jets will fly overhead, and the dancers will pirouette on the ice, and I don't think there'll be any technical failures. In terms of a political mistake of shining the world's attention on Russia, I mean, that's already happened. Is it unfair that Russia is coming under this level of scrutiny? Well, as I said earlier, I support an unofficial leaders boycott of the Sochi opening ceremony, but I would have supported the same for China. And there is lots of talk in the Russian news that Russia is being presented as the number one enemy of gay rights. But in fact, it was India that passed a law criminalizing homosexuality. And the US will not be putting India under similar stress, and would not be, of course, boycotting an Indian Olympics if they were taking place.
Well, they have their own diplomatic problems with India right now.
Yes.
But interestingly, the International Olympic Committee has said that they're going to relax the rules for the first time and allow athletes to speak out on issues that don't directly concern sport, as long as they're not doing it in the sporting arena.
But this was a huge mistake for Putin, which is that the French philosopher Baudrillard once said that when he first went to the Soviet Union, he sat in the airport at Cheremetyevo, and he realised that Russia was a woolly mammoth, and that communism had preserved under the ice and the ice of isolation from the world all the pre-World War II attitudes towards gay rights, towards Jews, towards blacks, towards women, and that Russia was in a sense a kind of survivor from a previous era with a morality of a previous time. Is what happened here is that Putin and his team could not believe that gay rights were a serious thing in the West. They were operating in a mindset 20 years ago, even longer, and they thought this was a simple, cheap way to drum up populist support, not something that would be on the priorities of world leaders.
And it's something we're going to be keeping a very close eye on here. Ben Judah, thanks very much indeed for coming on the show.
Coming up after this very short break, it's been nearly 25 years since the Lockerbie bombings. We look at how aviation has changed and the questions that remain over the trial after the attack.
Whether you're in Ankara or Abu Dhabi, start your day with The Globalist. We'll bring you the world in an hour with comment and analysis on the day's news and the business stories that will be shaping your day.
Banking was never one of the biggest problems in Portugal, even during the crisis.
This is over a decade. Does anybody really believe that the agreement that is reached, let's say even if we did it today, is going to stick for a decade? No one believes that.
And don't miss the monologue. Are editors pithy, funny, or just brutally honest takes on the people and places making the headlines for all the right and wrong reasons?
You can be half sold on a deal if you find yourself happy and content to sit and wait in their lobby.
Could a Europe-wide TV service work? What would such a broadcast outfit even look like?
A friendly cab driver or a tasty breakfast is now an unexpected surprise. And when it comes to what happens on board, well, anything short of a derailment is bliss.
That's The Globalist on Monocle 24 every weekday at 6 a.m. London time. The Globalist is brought to you in association with GE.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal, for everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working-class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. It is 9:19 in Rome. It's 8:19 here in London. And next, though, we turn to a story whose impact can still be felt around the world today. On the 21st of December, 1988, Pan Am Flight 103 departed for JFK Airport from London's Heathrow.
During the flight, a bomb was detonated on board, killing all 243 passengers and 16 crew members, while the debris from the plane killed 11 people on the ground in the Scottish town of Lockerbie. This Saturday will be the 25th anniversary of the attack, for which Libyan citizen Abdelbaset al-Megrahi was found guilty by the Scottish courts.
Well, in just a moment, we'll look at the trial of al-Megrahi, but first, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, told me how the attack has changed aviation forever. Tristan, it's nearly been a quarter of a century since the Lockerbie incident. A radical change in those 25 years, hasn't it, when it comes to aviation security?
Massive changes, and I don't know that we can necessarily attribute it to specifically to Lockerbie, but I think you can say that there's sort of a lineage of events. Of course, 9/11 is part of that, but it's interesting looking at these photos 25 years later and seeing this plane sitting, all the debris sitting on the ground, thinking that the plane literally just exploded in flight because a bomb was placed in the cargo hold. The idea of that happening today is very far-fetched. Security has changed radically since then, and still we're having discussions about this. Still we're having, you know, the fallout from something like this is so massive. Again, 25 years later, still conspiracy theories arising, still so much that seems sort of unknown, but we have come very far, and some people say too far, in terms of security.
Many people would wonder, thinking back 25 years ago, how that could even happened in the first place? How was it that, the bags weren't properly screened?
It seemed to me, and I think I can recall, at least from personal experience, that, we used to be able to walk to the gates. We used to be able to see our family, see our friends off, and of course, I remember during, especially in the United States, during the first Gulf War, that all changed. All of a sudden, there was more security at airports. All of a sudden, you couldn't get so far into the terminal if you weren't traveling. I think what you've seen is a mixture of technology, but also vigilance has made it so they can screen for these sorts of things. What's interesting, of course, with Pan Am 103 was that there was that sort of crazy threat up front that a flight potentially from Germany to the United States was going to be bombed. That didn't end up happening. And of course, threats are very common nowadays. You see them all the time. They shut airports down. I think what this has done, or what incidents like Pan Am 103, what incidents like 9/11 have done, is they've made it so we take every little thing very seriously. It's easy to say something. It's even harder to do it. But still, every time it's said, we assume as though it will be done. And I think that's really the heart of what has kept us safe.
And you mentioned, of course, September 11th there. Do you think that the Lockerbie incident 25 years ago, or perhaps the September 11th incident back in 2001, was the pivotal moment that really changed the future of aviation security?
I think it's a big part of it. But, it is a bit of an apples to oranges comparison, just because those who, at least allegedly, or those who were eventually proven to have perpetrated the 103 incident were not on board the airplane. 9/11 was a different case. And I think it's really hard to sort of program that factor out. Is someone who's willing to get on an airplane and die for the cause, it's a far different story than someone who's willing to put the bomb there and then walk away. And I think in a lot of ways, it may even be easier to prevent the first than the latter. So I don't know. It's anyone's guess as to sort of what the future of this will be. But it seems that now there's a lot more sort of cooperation between international authorities in terms of not only law enforcement investigations, but also in terms of aviation safety. Just the world has dramatically changed in terms of aviation in these past 25 years.
And just talking about 9/11 finally, that was somewhat 12 years ago. We had the crazy amount of security that's still in place today. But we are seeing the relaxation of some rules when it comes to carrying certain size liquids on board and things like that. Do you think that because it has been 12 years since that horrific incident, that now sometimes people feel they can perhaps let their guard down even slightly?
That's another very good question. I think we're always riding this line in this industry of passenger convenience and comfort and safety. And, if you look at it sort of in terms of like a hierarchy of things that matter, safety always is at the top. And so then how do you reconcile making the travel experience pleasant for people in terms of the safety. So, I mean, I can't necessarily say that relaxing the restrictions on liquids on airplanes is necessarily like lack of vigilance, but I will say that I think that technology has gotten to a point where they feel like they can address the issues that they were addressing by banning it, by now putting it through certain scanners, by now doing those, you know, if you've ever been through security and they rub that little dab of cloth on it and then test it. And so, you know, lots of different things to think about. But then we come into this territory of now they're making guns out of plastic. You know, they're printing guns with 3D printers. And sure, they can get one or two rounds off. But at the end of the day, you know, the game changes very fast. And as we're enabling more people to manufacture things, do things on their own, really democratizing methods of creation and manufacturing, the game is always changing.
That was Monocle's transport editor there, Tristan McAllister, speaking to me just a little bit earlier. Now, turning now to the trial that took place after the incident, the author of a book that alleges that the man found guilty for the attack, Abdelbassat Al-Megrahi, was the victim of so-called dirty politics, a flawed investigation, and judicial folly.
John Ashton, author of Megrahi, You Are My Jury, and more recently, Scotland's Shame, Why Lockerbie Still Matters, joins us on the show now. Welcome to the programme, John.
Good morning.
Why does Lockerbie still matter?
Well, it's the biggest mass murder in British history, in Western Europe, in Western European times. It's the worst terrorist attack. The wrong man was convicted as a consequence of charges being brought against Libya. The entire country of Libya was subjected to 7 years of very biting sanctions, needlessly, which plunged the country into poverty. And the real murderers got away with it. In a nutshell, that's why it still matters.
And Megrahi believes that he was framed, and you argue in your books that it was a political fix. Who do you think was behind this so-called political fix, as you put it then?
Well, just to be clear, I don't think there was a mass conspiracy involving the police, the intelligence services, the judges, etc. I think there were two things going on. In Scotland, looked at the level of the prosecution and the conviction, then I think that is just a sort of self-imposed pressure to nail somebody for the crime. But I think at an international level, there was a deliberate move to subvert the investigation, which was all to do with the U.S.'s international relations at the time. They had a very complex relationship with Iran, and I believe that Iran commissioned this bombing. Particularly complex was the negotiations and the situation regarding U.S. hostages. And at the same time, they had an obsession with Gaddafi and Libya. And they were running a covert campaign to supply weapons to Iran only a couple of years before to make deals over hostages. And at the same time, they were running a massive covert campaign to unseat Gaddafi. So these two imperatives for the U.S. government collided. And Lockerbie is where they collided.
Now, you mentioned Libya, and their justice minister has now said that the Britain and American authorities may question the former intelligence chief, Abdullah Senussi. Is this a big development?
If it happens, it will be, yes. But I don't see how it's going to help the investigation, because Senussi is going to deny it. And there is no evidence to support it. And in the 2 years since the fall of Gaddafi, not a single piece of evidence has emerged publicly to say that either Megrahi or Gaddafi were involved. The only genuine document to emerge from the ruins of the former government's offices is a letter which was reported by the Wall Street Journal from Megrahi to Senussi saying, "I'm innocent, help to get me out of here." That's it. That's the sum total of the evidence that's emerged publicly.
John, let's talk about another report, and I'm referring to this Operation Bird report, which was written by Jessica DeGrazia and Philip Corbett. Now, this was first written back in 2002, but never published, but details are now emerging from this report that they suggest that it was an Egyptian who was behind this attack, Mohammed Abu Talib. Now, that is a claim that you deny.
Yeah, well, I think the overall conclusion of the report, which was that it was a group called the PFLPGC, a Palestinian group that was commissioned by Iran, is correct. I just would challenge some of the factual detail in there. I mean, I think that Mohammed Abu Taib was involved somewhere down the line, but I don't think he was the actual bomber, because 2 months before Lockerbie happened, he had been arrested, and therefore he was compromised. He probably suspected that he was, rightly suspected that he was being observed, and so too were the people who were pulling the strings higher up. So I think that element of the report is unlikely.
So we have, you know, all these different investigations, all these different reports. It's been 25 years since the actual incident, and it just seems like no one really knows who did it, and it doesn't seem like there's any end game in sight.
Well, we know broadly who did it, but as for the individuals, we don't know. I mean, the man at the top of the tree in terms of the operation is a man called Ahmed Jibril, who is the leader of the PFLP-GC. He was commissioned by Iran. We don't know exactly who commissioned him in the Iranian government, but the name Mutashemi has come up time and time again. He was the person who, at the time, had the closest contacts with the terrorist groups who were operating out of Lebanon and Syria. And U.S. intelligence documents, declassified U.S. intelligence documents, said that he paid $10 million for the Lockerbie operation. Now, that's, you know, this is the U.S. government's own intelligence agencies saying it.
Finally, John Swire, who is the father of one of the victims of the attack, has been talking recently about Scottish independence and how this massive failure in what he sees as a massive failure of the Scottish justice system will really influence that.
Well, the criminal justice system is the foremost independent institution in Scotland. It has been independent for a long, long time. And now, if the criminal justice system screws up so badly on this case, then it does beg questions about what will happen if Scotland is fully independent. Will those other institutions that become independent screw up so badly? In that sense, it could influence independence. Now, I don't say that Lockerbie is high up on the agenda of most Scots who will vote in this, but it might make them reflect on the future of the country if this small criminal justice system, which is very inward-looking and which is perhaps not as influenced as it should be by concerns around this case. If the criminal justice system messes up like that, then what future is there for a Scotland that's fully independent? I mean, I don't hold a view on whether Scotland should become independent or not, but I do think that this might influence the debate.
John, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for joining us on the program. John Ashton, author of a new book, which is out on Booksands now, Scotland's Shame, Why Lockerbie Still Matters. Thanks for joining us on the show.
In the next half an hour of the program, we'll take a look at the Italian press and we'll find the Norwegians are snatching Christmas presents. We'll be looking back at some of the biggest design stories from the past year.
I think there's still a lot of soul searching. The fact that this company, for all intents and purposes, you know, it's fully Swiss owned. And a big question mark as to, does it even have a future in Finland?
And first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Amnesty International says that war crimes are being committed in the Central African Republic as calls grow for the UN to intervene. It says 2 weeks ago, rebels killed almost 1,000 people in a two-day rampage, double an earlier UN estimate. A summit is getting underway in Brussels where EU leaders will focus on a deal agreed overnight by finance ministers on tighter controls for the banking system. A new body is to be set up to take action against failing lenders to prevent the type of financial crisis seen in Ireland, Cyprus and Spain. A White House-appointed panel has made 40 recommendations to change the way the National Security Agency carries out surveillance in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks. It says in future, any monitoring of world leaders would have to be approved at the highest level. Those NSA leaks appear to have led to Brazil deciding not to agree a deal with American company Boeing for new fighter jets. Instead, Swedish company Saab has won the $4.5 billion contract. Earlier this year, it was revealed the NSA had spied on the Brazilian president. One of the most powerful figures in Japanese politics, Tokyo Governor Naoki Inoue, has stepped down after being embroiled in a financial scandal. He led the Japanese capital's successful bid to host the 2020 Summer Olympics, but quit following claims about taking bribes from a scandal-hit hospital executive ahead of an election. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. A pleasure as always seeing you here in the studio. We'll be back in just under 30 minutes from now with another check of the world headlines. But in the meantime, it's time for us to get a check of the top stories in one particular part of the world. And today we're going to be heading to Scandinavia to hear the news from Norway. Lars Bevanger joins us on the line. Lars, welcome to the program. We're less than a week away from Christmas, and I understand that's really what everyone's talking about in Norway as well.
There's not much other news around, so it's Christmas all around. One of the top stories running today is by the national broadcaster NRK, and they've been looking at how many of this year's Christmas presents under Norwegian trees might be stolen goods. Because you would think that in one of the richest countries in the world, people could afford to at least buy each other Christmas presents, but it turns out that people in Norway are stealing goods for about £80 million during the Christmas shopping periods. That's the 6 weeks leading up to Christmas. They have also checked who steals, and it turns out 70% are shoppers, but 30% of those who are stealing Christmas presents are actually staff stealing from their own employers, from the shops they are working in.
And what are they stealing, mostly?
Anything. Alcohol is high on the list because alcohol is very expensive in Norway. Electronics, clothes, DVDs, food even. So there doesn't seem to be any limit to the kind of goods that people actually manage to put in their pockets and walk out of the shops with.
But Lars, does this underscore a potentially more serious problem in that, you know, in the past couple of months, past year or so, the Norwegian economy has been struggling quite a bit. And in turn, lots of people are finding a lot more tough to just get by.
Well, the Norwegian economy has struggled a bit, but nothing compared to many other European countries, including the UK. And people are much better off in Norway than countries they can compare themselves to elsewhere in Europe. So it's hard to find an excuse, but I think perhaps the expectations are now so high that you're supposed to give very expensive gifts that perhaps for some of these people it is a bit of a challenge to be able to afford, you know, to buy iPads for everyone. No, not many people can do that. So perhaps the expectations have become so sky high that people resort to stealing.
And of course it has a knock-on effect to consumers because prices go up to make up for those losses.
Yeah, that's right. The losses that the shops are incurring, they are passing on to other consumers. So in this survey, they've calculated that it's going to cost about £35 a head on average in increased prices.
Well, Lars, let's stay with the silly season theme now. I know Georgina and I wish we could potentially have some beer and marzipan in the studio right now. It might be a bit early, but no, I don't think it's never too early when you're looking forward to Christmas. But it looks like marzipan is big news there in Norway.
Oh, marzipan is a huge thing in Norway over Christmas. some people make their own, but most people will buy it. Or steal it, perhaps. But the newspapers, lacking real news, if you like, you call it a silly season, and it is a bit. They run all kinds of tests on Christmas-related food and drink, and marzipan is one that features heavily in one of the big tabloids today. And one of the winners is from Denmark, would you believe it? One of the competitive Nordic countries to the south, there are lots of other tests as well related to Christmas that other newspapers will be carrying in the run-up to Christmas.
A lot of them to do with alcohol.
Yes, beer, Christmas beer. All the big breweries in Norway and the small breweries are putting out special Christmas brew for Christmas. Typically a bit stronger, a bit darker than your normal lager, which most people are drinking throughout the year. And it's great because in Norway, alcohol advertisement is banned. So for the breweries, it's brilliant that they get all this editorial content published in the run-up to Christmas. And it's the best job for a journalist ever, to test Christmas brews. I know, I've done it myself, and it's fantastic. But you do lose your ability to judge towards the end of the session, I must say.
Who doesn't like things a bit stronger and darker, huh, Georgina?
Let's talk about going on cycle paths, particularly after you've been drinking perhaps some of that beer, because before it used to be a lot more dangerous. And now snow ploughs, I believe, are clearing not only all the roads, but the cycle paths too.
Yeah, this is happening in Oslo and some other Norwegian cities as well. The Oslo City Council has now just decided that they're going to clear cycle paths of snow as well. You might think that people put their bikes away when the snow is coming down over Christmas and for the rest of the winter, which it does do in most of Norway. But a lot of people still commute on their bikes, but just over 10% of people in Oslo cycle to work year-round. And it's usually a big problem because the snow plows, they will clear the roads for the traffic, for the cars. But all that snow is then just thrown up onto the cycle path, and it makes it really dangerous for the cyclists to have to then share the roads with the cars. But now the council has said, no, we're going to clear the cycle paths as well, and we're going to make sure that at least 68 kilometres of cycle paths are clear and safe for cyclists to use throughout the winter period.
I'm quite interested, Lars, how are they going to go about doing this? So they have special cycle path snow plows, because obviously the cycle paths are a lot more narrow than the roads in Oslo, or are they going to be doing it manually?
I think not manually, no. I think that would be taking job creation too far. But they do have various sizes of snow plows. They also got, those little electric vehicles that usually brush the pavements in this country. They've got sort of snow adapted variations of those as well that can fit on a pavement.
And Lars Bevanger, our contributor on Norway and Scandinavia. Many thanks for bringing us up to speed.
After this very short break, we'll be looking back at some of the biggest design stories from the past year. Stay tuned.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with Phil Hahn and me, Georgina Godwin. It's 41 minutes past the top of the hour. Now, in a preview of what's to come on Monocle 24, all next week and the week after, the Globalist Show will be looking back and forecasting ahead through the focus of affairs, business, culture, design and edits.
Well, for the design show airing at 0600 hours London time on Thursday, our design editor Tom Morris is joined by our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and creative director Richard Spencer Powell, and they're looking back at the biggest design stories from 2013. Beginning with the changes at Artek, here's a snippet of what you can expect.
It was quite incredible because I was in Finland a few weeks ago, and that story is still reverberating. And I think on one side, you have a lot of people, really sort of asking these questions. Can Finland sustain this type of business? Why didn't it work out? And as we know, Artek, venerable brand, was owned by Proventus, a private equity company out of Sweden. It gets snatched up by one of the world's most respected companies in the world of design in general. And really, if you look at the commitment that Rolf Feilbaum, the owner and founder, has to architecture and industrial design and urbanism. He's created his own little world practically. It's quite amazing. And yet, I think Finland is in many ways it's such a closed market, and the Finns are quite special and they're very protective of their brands. And so, I think there's still a lot of soul searching. The fact that this company, for all intents and purposes, it's fully Swiss owned, and a big question mark is to, does it even have a future in Finland? Could this just be another brand that migrates to other cities? There's also a huge look that they might move their center of gravity from Helsinki to Berlin, for example.
Yeah. Do you think Artek
want to sort of try and keep that Finnishness, which is so much part of our tech and the sort of DNA of the brand? Or
I think they have to, because yes, you want to push the brand forward, but I think there's, you know, there's an opportunity to still be one of those players out of that region. The Japanese like the fact that this is a brand that is from Finland, not that it's something which happens to be designed in Finland and made somewhere else.
Next up, Louis Vuitton, a new man in the hot seat. Yeah, is it much of a surprise that he...
It's not much of a surprise. It's about as surprising that when we heard that Nicolas Ghesquiere was going there, it was almost as surprising as that we heard that Tom Daley was gay. So no, it was amazing to sort of listen and how this unfolded for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we thought we were going to get this official statement. And then finally, you know, it is released. And I think when we look at it on balance, I think it is a good thing. Marc Jacobs, very talented, but I think it was time for him to move on to a new assignment.
And another sort of man in the movement this year, past year, has been Richard Rodgers, who's celebrated.
I'd like to say Richard Spencer Powell, who's been very quiet. He's in the studio. Our creative director is also here as well. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Rich, your take on Richard Rodgers? Did you get out to see the show early this year?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see it, but I'm a fan of him, actually. I think he's a very interesting and important figure. And I think what's really nice about celebrating his work is that lots of these sort of star architects that build these things all over the world, not everyone gets to see them. And so I think by housing it in an exhibition, people can come and actually see the work and talk about it. And I think he's been so outspoken about London, and I think rightly so, his battles with Prince Charles. I think it's good for people to look at that work and have a bit of a debate about it, because I think he makes some very valid points about the way you build a city.
Absolutely. Rich, why we wanted to get you in here in particular was to talk about a couple of interesting rebrand subjects which have happened over the past couple of months. First up was the big Sweden renovation, which we've discussed before, but...
I think big.
No, I've got you both.
I think big's maybe the wrong word there. 1 year in the making, and it's the Swedish flag. Interesting. I've done a little bit of research about that after we initially covered it, and I think one of the disappointments there is that the way they announced it was just simply, oh, here's the flag, here's the rebrand, we're either genius or idiots. I can't remember what their quote was. But actually, if you then go to their website and see all the other branding work they've done, it is a bit more expansive than they've actually kind of initially kind of let on. And I don't really know why they did it with such a sort of...
You mean the way they released it, or...?
Yeah, the way they released it.
It was sort of apologetic, wasn't it?
A little bit of a sort of squeaky fart, really. I think they should have announced it and shown more of it, because who knows, it could be really great, but I just think I don't know why they just came out with such a sort of meager offering.
Next up, American Airlines, who early this summer had a bit of a rejig.
Well, they did.
This is quite
remarkable, because I think so many people have long loved American Airlines for the fact that they just have these aluminium, metallic fuselages. They never paint their aircraft. I was not a fan in the very beginning. It was very Captain America. It seemed a little bit sort of too vocal and loud, but I guess with lots of things, I didn't like Finnair in the beginning as well. I liked sort of the sky blue, and then suddenly you had this very sort of dark navy and this massive Finnair down the fuselage. But at least we're seeing some type of graphic innovation on the part of U.S. carriers, because they've been so tired for so long. And I think we only have to look at the last merger between Continental and United, where they just took the Continental tail and they kept United at the front of the plane, which was just a massive cost savings exercise. And again, I sort of feel not unlike the Swedish rebrand. Rich, I don't know what you think.
I sort of secretly quite like them. I think it's quite a crisp bit of work, actually. Yeah. It's neat. And I think so many tail fins are still quite bland. I mean, it's such a great job to do an aeroplane, and there's quite a few naff ones out there. And
yeah,
I liked it. And it's punchy.
It has presence as well. I think the other thing you should say, or we can say about American too, is that they have ambition on the inside. So they've got a new series of Airbus A321s that they've ordered, which they're going to be flying transcontinental in the United States now with a proper first class. They're introducing flat beds, because it's not exactly a short hop between JFK and LAX.
And that's our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé with Richard Spencer-Powell, and our design editor Tom Morris looking back at 2013 and the big design stories. And you can hear the rest of that discussion on the show next Thursday.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's Italian front pages with Monocle's David Pleasant. But to get us there, let's indulge in a spot of Christmas party music, shall we? This is Marvin Gaye with Got to Give It Up.
Oh,
Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye there. Well, we're fast approaching the end of the show, but before we go, let's take a look at the Italian front pages with our researcher, David Pleasant. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Georgina. Hello.
Hello. It's Christmas time and we should all be cheerful and it's full of lovely stories, but sadly the world doesn't work like that and some of the uglier sides of humanity still very clearly on view with this latest story out of Lampedusa.
Exactly. Sadly, as you say, it's a seasonal time, but not so seasonal for some of the inmates at the internment camps for the immigrants that are found off the coast of Lampedusa. A video has been leaked of very dire treatment of migrants at this reception centre that includes footage of them being stripped and hosed down. The authorities there have justified this treatment by saying it's a kind of disinfecting kind of process that's very necessary given the conditions that some of the migrants find themselves in when they're found. But that hasn't stopped the Italian various Italian groups and politicians claim kind of protesting and saying that this treatment is absolutely appalling. The Speaker of Parliament, Laura Baldrini, said that the treatment of migrants was unworthy of a civilised country, and that view's been echoed by many voices in Italy,
including the mayor of Lampedusa, who said that the scenes of the camp there, the reception facility, reminded him of a concentration camp.
Yeah, and we should, it's worth mentioning the kind of citizens of Lampedusa, and the mayor particularly, have been praised for their actions and their role within welcoming a lot of these migrants when the state wasn't intervening. The actual citizens have been praised. And so I think it is probably worth mentioning how this is probably very little to do with the people who actually live there. And on a daily basis, we're seeing help and kind of donations and support of the many hundreds and thousands of migrants who are finding themselves on this tiny little island.
You say the authorities are justifying, but that's the authorities of the camp itself. The government has in fact ordered an inquiry into this, and the UN Human Rights Commission and the EU have all complained.
Exactly. The EU was in the process of fining the Italian government for this treatment, this inadequate treatment. So I think that's pushed the Italian state to launch an inquiry. So, all eyes on what they will find, really. But it does seem strange that this has been going on, for many weeks. And there have been kind of only on Tuesday, 110 people were rescued from the sea. And yet this kind of treatment is happening. Someone pointed to how terrible it was that a lot of the people who were probably involved in who were seen in this footage were survivors of the big the big disaster in October, in which 366 people died, and yet these people are still subjected to this kind of treatment.
And of course, the key issue there is the hundreds and thousands of refugees that are fleeing Africa and mainly landing in Lampedusa to try to have a new life. An interesting figure: some 1,200 migrants are currently in residence at this facility, but the facility was only designed for something like 250 people. So are there plans by the Italians to perhaps create new facilities? How are they going to deal with the root of this problem?
Well, I think there's been a kind of political issue here for a long time, whereby if the government kind of expresses a willingness to expand the centre, to make it into kind of a huge depot, then it's kind of admitting the failures of the whole system, really, and also kind of admitting a willingness to accept hundreds of thousands of more people, which is obviously what has there has been a resistance to that. But I think this summer's events have kind of like are leading to a turning point. And it has to be said that the situation in Syria, the kind of collapse of proper authorities in Libya have kind of like opened the way for this kind of this flood of illegal migration. But yeah, I think you're right. We're going to have to see. I mean, I'm following this inquiry, one presumes that we're going to see big changes at Lampedusa.
David, what else do you have for us from Italy?
Another story, perhaps this is a bit better news, certainly for the people involved. Alitalia, the beleaguered carrier, Italian carrier, is in the process of apparently signing a deal with Etihad, the Emirates carrier, whereby they would inject some 300 million euros into the company, making it the largest single stakeholder. This comes off the back of news earlier in the year that Air France KLM effectively pulled out of Alitalia, kind of due to lack of confidence and a spiraling costs to them of their stake. So they pulled out from 25% down to 8%. That was leaving a huge gap in Alitalia's budget.
And it's a very clever strategy for Etihad and their CEO, James Hogan, who have been known in the past while to be taking more equity stakes in smaller carriers in Europe, India and Australia. That only goes to strengthen kind of their network and to improve passenger flows, isn't it, when it goes through their hub in Abu Dhabi?
Well, yeah, although it's probably quite risky. I mean, nobody knows. They've invested in various airlines in India, Australia, and, yeah, and some smaller carriers in Europe. This is probably the biggest kind of biggest single in investment that we're seeing out of them. Some people agreeing with you. I mean, it is maybe quite a canny move. Alitalia has been beleaguered, but it operates a kind of important market. You know, it's got some big hubs, Milan, Rome, and so on, that still, you know, have a huge kind of amount of passengers. And I think the tussle between airlines that are wanting or not wanting to get involved in Alitalia is whether they can themselves strategize themselves in those key Italian points and basically usurp Alitalia's influence on those hubs.
David, very quickly, a look at the Italian media and a story that's coming from there.
Yeah, from Sicily. This is a story from Il Fatto Quotidiano, the Daily Fact newspaper. This is basically saying that the government of Sicily is giving the publishers of the island a big fat Christmas present to the value of 1.5 million euros. This is a surprising move from Rosario Crocetta, the quite controversial leader of the Sicilian government. He's kind of turning around the cuts that have beset the island and has decided to invest in state support for a lot of the island's newspapers.
David, excellent stuff. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks very much, David, for coming in and having a look through this morning's Italian front pages. And also many thanks to our producer, Alad John, a very talented man indeed, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Iona McLaren. And of course, studio manager, who's equally talented in all respects, is Bill Luti. Well, up next after the news is Culture with Robert Bound. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday here in London. That's 7 a.m. in New York. We'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.